Friends, what I propose to do in this lecture is to introduce the basic tenets of Advaita Vedanta and the way the Advaita has formed as a philosophical school in India by Shankara. So in this, what I want to do is, first, I want to show how the term Advaita has been distinctly brought out by Shankara, and to show how the schools, three schools of Advaita, Vishishta Advaita and Dvaita have interacted with each other in propagating their own brand of Vedanta. And I conclude this lecture with the philosophization that has taken place in India as distinct from that in the West and the position of Advaita in that analysis. So the word Advaita refers to a system of Vedantic thought which believes in a non-dualistic ultimate reality. Shankaracharya is the chief exponent of this system. But he was not the first to propound this thinking. As a system named as Vedanta, it claims its allegiance to the Vedas, Vedanam Antaha. So that is how it is. And as per the meaning of the term, it is understood to be the last part of the Vedas. That is how the word means. Vedanta means the last part of the Vedas. But it is not always the case. The Vedas are divided into four parts, namely Samhita, Brahmana, Aranyaka and Upanishads. The last part called Upanishad is otherwise known as Vedanta, or it is taken to be a system which has Upanishad as its pramana, the means of knowledge, pramana. That means Vedanta is otherwise called as the system for which Upanishads are pramanas, means. That means Upanishads go to make a Vedanta. That is what is told, like Vedanto nama Upanishad pramanam. However, it has not been the case always that it comes at the end portion of the Vedas. Since there are Upanishads which come in the Aranyaka portion, like Taittiriya Upanishad, and there are some which are in Brahmana portion, like Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So, the Veda, and then the Vedas consists of two parts. The earlier part is known as Karmakanda, and the later part is known as Jnanakanda. The Jnanakanda is usually taken to be the portion which is termed as Vedanta, or which is the source of Vedantic thinking. Now, in Vedanta, we have several schools claiming the status of independent Vedanta schools. Why should there be so many Vedantic schools? The answer to this question lies in the conceiving the reality in multifarious ways by the acharyas who tried their hand to explain a hermeneutic analysis by engaging in an exegesis of the Vedas. There are certain points of agreement and difference among the schools of Vedanta. All the Vedantic schools are in total agreement with the fact that there is a ultimate reality called Brahman. They accept the Vedas as the source of knowledge. All the Vedantic schools do that. But the disagreement lies in conceiving the nature of the ultimate reality as portrayed in the Vedas. The Vedas have a large number of statements which talk of unity or non-difference. And though there are also a large number of such hymns which talk of difference, the former variety of texts are known as Abheda Shruti texts, which talk about non-different nature of the ultimate reality. Abheda Shruti texts, and the later texts are known as Bheda Shruti texts, that which talk about difference, that there is difference in the reality. Among the Vedantins, some give importance to Abheda Shruti and they come to be known as Advaitins. It is Advaitins who emphasize a lot on this Abheda Shruti passages of the Vedas. And Shankara belongs to this group. The Advaitins interpret the Bheda Shruti passages in order to suit their context. See, since they have to work within the boundary of the Upanishads, they also have to confront with such passages which talk about Veda or difference. And what they do is, they try to analyze it, saying that in some way they can be accommodated within the limits, the periphery of the non-difference. Almost exactly like the Arthavada Vakyas. You know, the Vedas have two types of Vakya, Vidhi Vakya and Arthavada Vakya. The Vidhi Vakya for Mimamsakas is important, and Arthavada Vakyas are, there are two types of statements, please. There are two types of statements in the Vedas. One is Vidhi Vakya, another is Arthavada Vakya. Vidhi Vakya is injunctive statements. That means something to be done or not done. That is injunctions. There are certain injunctions. And there are certain passages which are simply eulogizing things. So, those eulogy statements are taken as secondary statements which either support or not support the vidhi statements, the injunctive statements. So, in that way, the Advaitins interpret the Veda Shruti passages, that is the passages containing difference, in order to suit their context, almost exactly like the Veda Arthavada Vakyas are interpreted. Like they say that even though the reality is ultimately non-dual, in its empirical level, duality, namely Saguna Brahman, is accepted. So they accept duality in the empirical level. Ultimately, Advaitin will have nothing to do with the duality. But the duality, the Vedic passages containing difference are interpreted in the sense of empirical reality. That is how the Veda Shruti passages are interpreted. For Advaita, the chief import of the Vedas lie in the Abheda Shruti passages only. The case is diametrically opposite in Dvaita school of Vedanta. Madhva says that the chief import of the Vedic passages lie in portraying difference. That is Veda. It is Veda which is the chief import of all the Shruti passages. Now, how the Abheda Shruti passages are again interpreted, analyzed by him? He says, Abheda Shruti passages are secondary in nature. They are not primary. The primary are those which talk about difference, because Madhva talks about a dualistic school. Madhva propounds a school called Dvaita school. So, Abheda passages are definitely Gauna, that is secondary, and are meant to say, so the supreme quality and independent nature of the God, that is the Lord Vishnu. That means there are certain Abheda passages that has to be interpreted, and he says that Abheda passages are interpreted to show the independent nature of the God. Okay? So he says that suppose we say that there is one man in the village, it refers to the richest man in the village. Okay, so Eka is taken to show the excellent qualities of a person. So, excellent quality of an entity here in Dvaita school, Madhva says that the Abheda Shruti passages are meant to show the unexcelled qualities of the God, that is Lord Vishnu, he accepts as the ultimate reality. He is Swatantra, independent, and other means the world and the Jiva, consisting of the world and soul, are Paratantra, that is dependent. And in that, only they are meaningful. In the development of Vedantic thought, in between Shankara and Madhva, appeared Ramanuja, who propounded that both the types of Shruti passages are equally meaningful. He says all the Shruti passages are meaningful. This is called as Veda Veda Shruti or Ghataka Shruti passages, which find meaning in all types of Shruti passages. And for him and other Sri Vaishnavas, even the Karma Kanda is as important as the Jnana Kanda. See, this is a very important milestone in the Vedantic thinking in India, that Karmakanda is the first time Ramanuja said that it is Ekashastra. Veda cannot be divided into two, Karmakanda and Jnanakanda. Jnanakanda cannot have any preeminence, superiority on Karmakanda. He says Karmakanda has to be pursued along with Jnanakanda. So Karmakanda is as important as Jnanakanda, as they form Aikya Shastra, one text. And Jnanakanda does not have any preeminence or superiority over Karmakanda as enunciated by Shankara and other Advaitins. For Shankara, it is not even Jnanakanda. It is Mahavakyas which are enough. Four Mahavakyas, if you know, one knows the meaning of four Mahavakyas, that is enough. If a person has the real adhikari, eligibility, Shankara says one word will do tattvamasi. That is the whole of it. So now that type of interpretation has been given by Shankara, whereas Ramanuja says no. It is the whole lot of Vedas, Karmakanda as well as Jnanakanda, which are necessarily to be pursued by a person who wants to get liberated or wants to know Vedanta. Historically, Ramanuja's advent was prior to that of Madhva. And the former, that is Ramanuja, holds an exegetical position, giving equal weightage to both the types of Shruti passages, which was not acceptable to Madhva. See, Madhva came later. So Madhva said Ramanuja has given weightage to both the types of Shruti passages, that is Abheda Shruti passages and Bheda Shruti passages. The passages which talk about Bheda, difference as well as Abheda, he has not done right. Ramanuja says that God is different from soul and the world. Howsoever, these two, namely the soul and the world, form his body, in that they are Abheda. See, they are different, at the same time non-different. They are distinct but inseparable. That is how he says. They are distinct. The God and soul are distinct from, world and soul are distinct from the God, but they are inseparable because they form the part of the God, the body of the God. There is sarira sariri bhava. One is sarira, the God is sariri, and they are sariras. Between them, Madhva appreciates the idea of difference. He says, okay, you say that there is some distinction between the God, soul and world, okay, that is right. But says, the difference is not adequate. Because you are accepting the non-difference also, the man can form the body of the God, how can he? Madhva says it is absolutely unacceptable to say any type of non-difference between God, man and world. So he says the difference that is propounded by Ramanuja is inadequate. As at some point Madhva feels that Ramanuja has compromised with Advaitins in propounding the idea of non-difference. The difference must be total for Madhva. He holds on to the view of Bheda, difference, and propounds the Panchabheda. There are five types of differences Madhva tries to uphold. He says everything must be different from the other thing, in which he brings about all the entities as different from other entities of the world. Howsoever, Ramanuja, following the tradition of Nathamuni and Yamuna, two of his predecessors, gave the foundation for the Vaishnava theistic schools, which branched off into many streams in the later periods. Shankara and the views of post-Shankara Vedantins have been taken into task at a large scale by all the theistic schools. Among them, Madhva is a champion. Basic doctrines of Advaita. Coming to Shankara, the philosophy he propounded was based on the basic conception that the non-dual supreme reality is without any quality or characteristic. Yeah, please come. It is here Ramanuja felt inconvenient, saying that, how can we contemplate of a reality which is without any characteristics? How do we conceive of such a reality? For him, Ramanuja, if there is no characteristic, there is no content. and a contentless object or a perception of a contentless object is a contradiction in term. How can you see? If it is a padartha, there is no content, it is not available for perception, it cannot be conceived either. It would be like a square circle. For Shankara, the first basic feature of Advaita is that. This is the first principle. The Vedas, that is Shruti, propound a reality which is without any characteristics whatsoever. In other words, Brahman is the only reality. For other schools, however, the reality is multifold. The second distinct feature of Advaita is that there is ignorance, maya, which is identical with avidya in the post-Shankara Advaita. And that is responsible for the appearance of Brahman as God. Ishvara is one step below than the Brahman. God and soul, that is Jiva and the world. Visheshtadvaitins even do not admit the existence of Maya at all. They say that Maya, the principle of Maya, has brought Shankara to accept all types of funny philosophy. So they say for them Advaitins Maya is a pseudo concept. There is no basis for Maya at all, and it has no standing at all. In his Mahapurva Bhaksha, Ramanuja finds sevenfold objections in the concept of Maya, and sevenfold objection saptavidha anupapatti. He says that seven ways I can say that the Maya cannot hold good. The concept of Maya cannot stand to reason. And in post-Ramanuja Vishishta Advaita, it multiplies. Vedanta Desika writes a text called Satta Dushani. There are 100 mistakes in accepting Maya. Anyway, the third is, this is the second proposition of Advaitin, that the Maya is responsible for world creation. The third is, the state of God and the soul are illusory. God, the Ishvara, as well as the Jiva are illusory, while the essential nature of both the Jiva as well as Ishvara are real. Ramanuja and Vaishnava Vedantins do not accept this. For them, no form, either God or the soul, can be illusory. If you say God and say it is illusory, it is wrong, they say. But Shankara says no. There is only one reality, that is Brahman. There is no second reality. If you accept the empirical reality, you have to accept Ishvara. Otherwise, there is no Ishvara. The fourth feature is that the world is superimposed on Brahman through Maya, and it cannot be either real or unreal. It is indeterminable. It is anirvachaniya. For Vaishnava thinkers, world is completely real. Ramanuja goes to the extent of saying that all illusory things are also real. The dream is also real. The fifth distinct feature of Advaita Vedanta is that the direct knowledge of the true nature of the Jiva as Brahman is the sole means to liberation. So, Shankara says that the knowledge of Jiva as Brahman is the main source, main means, or sole means to liberation. The Vaishnava thinkers think that by knowledge one cannot get liberated. I know something, I know that there is a Oxford, place called Oxford. Do I reach there? I know there is something called Madras. I don't go there. But Shankara says, if it is illusion, see, they don't accept illusion. For Shankara's scheme of philosophizing, it suits very well. Because he says, suppose you are in Oxford and you think you have to go to Oxford. What do? You don't have to do anything. You have to know that you are in Oxford. So that is what it is. So the Vaishnava thinkers think that by knowledge one cannot get liberated, which Shankara refutes. Shankara does not refute, Shankarites refute. Knowledge is necessary, who says? Ramanujas and other Vaishnavites say, but it is not sufficient. The bhakti, see, even all Vaishnava thinkers think, or they say, they propound that there is the necessity of knowledge, no doubt, but the knowledge must culminate in bhakti. Then only you can get liberation. But Shankara says on the just opposite way. He says, your bhakti is necessary, but it is not sufficient. What is sufficient is knowledge. You should have bhakti, but it must end, culminate in jnana, so that you get liberated. So Vaishnava thinkers think, yeah. Shankara holds it in a different way and says that all the karma and devotion are subordinate means to liberation, and the knowledge alone one can be liberated. The sixth feature of Advaita Vedanta is that liberation can be had here and now. They say that it is possible to get liberated. You know, it is just another little development of the Bodhisattva concept. They say you can get liberated here and now. There is no point doing everything and getting liberated after the death. Shankara says if medicine is taken, you have to get cured right away here. You know, suppose a doctor says you take medicine and you will be all right after your death. Nobody will take such medicine. So he says that it is Jivan Mukti which has to be accepted. But it is not acceptable to the Vaishnava thinkers, starting from Ramanuja. They believe in Jivan Mukti, and Shankarites believe in Jivan Mukti as against Videha Mukti accepted by Vaishnava schools. In such, the study of the God, soul and Jiva constitute the basic to all Vedantic schools. The theistic schools who believe in pluralism consider these to be distinct realities. Advaita considers them as manifestation of Brahman, which is pure consciousness and non-dual. Maya conceals the true nature of Brahman and projects the world, soul and God. Though God and soul are complex entities consisting the sentient element called consciousness and insentient element of Maya, avidya, as their characteristics. See, that is what God and soul both have, sentience as well as insentience, because they form essentially the consciousness along with the Maya, avidya, they become Jiva and Ishvara. The essential nature of God is a sentient element of consciousness, which is known as Brahman, and that of Jiva is known as Atman. The point of importance here is that though the state of being God and soul are illusory, their essential nature is real according to Advaita. The world is illusory appearance of Brahman, though Maya like a rope snake, through Maya, like a rope snake. The world is world of illusory appearance of Brahman through Maya, like a rope snake, which is caused through ignorance. Hence, no part of the world is real. See, Jiva, the Brahman part, the consciousness part of the Jiva, the soul, is real. However, as far as the world is concerned, it is totally unreal, like a rope snake. If a rope looks like a snake, that is called as a rope snake, that rope snake is absolutely unreal. There is no part of the rope snake which is real. Rope is real, yes. So, the rope snake is unreal. So, for Advaita, God is always aware of his essential quality as Brahman, and hence he is ever liberated. The Jiva, who wrongly identifies with the mind, body and the sense organs, is ignorant of its essential nature and undergoes transmigration. Hence, Advaitins say that this wrong identification which is produced by ignorance can be removed by knowledge, and that is the true knowledge, that is true nature of the Brahman, that its true nature is Brahman. From the above discussion, it can be seen that the term Advaita implies Brahman, which is devoid of duality, and also stands for the school, Advaita stands for the school, that enunciates reality to be non-dual. Here I would like to refer one more Advaita or Advaita tradition, which was prevalent in Indian subcontinent much before the advent of Acharya Shankara. The writer of Amarakosha refers to Buddha as Advaitavadin. He says, Shadavigyo Dasavalaha Advaitavadi Vinayakaha. So, even Buddha is being spoken of as an Advaitavadi. A close study of the Mandukya Karika reveals how Gaudapada was highly influenced by Buddha in formulating the tenets of Advaita. In his commentaries, also we find Shankara is not that vociferous in criticizing Buddha while he writes his Bhashya on Mandukya Karika, authored by his grand preceptor Gaudapada. Whereas his criticisms are quite pungent when he wrote commentary on Brahma Sutra, Tarkapada, where he says that the Buddha must have had hatred for his subjects, because of which he has propagated a thesis having contradictory views. Sometimes Buddhists say that the reality is sunya, sometimes they say vijnana, sometimes they say the reality is real. So the three types of things one person cannot say. If he says, he must be either mad or he must be trying to confuse others. That is what Shankara says. Shankara does not seem to be charitable to Buddha, who opened the door of liberation to one and all. Anyway, the Buddhist non-dualism must have had influences on Shankara to give a logical shape to his thinking. In fact, when we analyze the thinking of the Buddha, we find he has been so much influenced by the Upanishads, even though he strongly denied the validity of the Vedas as authority. To my mind, what Buddha wanted to do away with is the Karmakanda portion of the Vedas and prerogative of strong Brahminism, which was prominent during his period, and philosophy. His philosophy for liberation can be easily traced to Upanishads. The individuality of a separatist Buddhist ideology beyond the Upanishads was questioned by Gaudapada, who held that the whole lot of thinking of Buddha can be traced back to the Upanishads. That is what he has done. He almost made reconciliation between the Upanishads and Buddhism. See, Gaudapada told, what all you Buddha say, I can trace it to the smallest of the Upanishads, that is Mandukya Upanishad. And showed how even the smallest of the Upanishads would commend what Buddha said and what he wanted to say and he did not say. There is something naitad buddhena bhasitam. This is not what has been spoken by Buddha. He should have told that. After Gaudapada, it was Acharya Shankara who almost reconstructed Advaita with spice logic and Shruti, and showed how Buddhism is not logical, neither logical nor liberative. In his commentary to the first verse of the fourth chapter of Mandukya Karika, Shankara gives the meaning of the phrase. That phrase comes, Tambande Dvipadam Varam. I pray to that chief of the humans, Dvipadas, two-legged ones, Dvipadas. And he says, see, in that context it fits to say that it means only Buddha. But Shankara says that it is Vishnu. So, Dvipadam Varam as Vishnu, whereas contextually it would be appropriate to have the meaning as Buddha. Howsoever, Shankara was responsible for deifying Buddha as an avatar in Hindu pantheon, and building up his own brand of Advaita on that of Buddha. I would also like to refer that Advaita thinking with Maya was prevalent in pre-Gaudapada Shankara period. Sadhya Jyotish, a Kashmirian Saiva scholar, does not refer to either of them, Shankara or Gaudapada, while criticizing the views of Vedanta, which is similar to that of Advaita. Hence, the tradition of Advaita Upanishadic, which Shankara reiterates in his Bhashya several times, he says that my philosophy is Upanishadic philosophy. Asmagam tu Upanishadam darshanam, and comes down, and the tradition of Advaita comes down till today in an unbroken manner. It is a living philosophical system. The word Advaita is commented upon by Shankara in his Mandukya Karika Bhashya. Mandukya Karika Bhashya as Advaitam, where he says Advaitam Chaturtham Manyante Sa Atma Sa Vijnayaha, but it was Madhusudana Saraswati. See, he says that not Dvaitam, where there is Dvaita Bhava, there is the absence of duality. In that sense, he comments the Mandukya Karika passage of Gaudapada. Shankara does it. But it was Madhusudana Saraswati in 16th century who, having the opponent's view in his mind, defines Advaita in his Siddhanta Bindu as Nasti Dvaitam Yatra. He says that in that substratum in which there is no duality. The substratum Yatra is used. He feels that to counter the Madhyamikas, who also talk of a non-dualistic entity called Sunya, it is necessary to put Yatra in the definition as its locus. That is Brahman, there is no trace of dualism. Get my point? See, a Madhyamika would define Advaita as non-Dvaita Advaita, where there is no duality. Because they don't have, because the Sunya, the concept of Sunya, emptiness, would not take any duality whatsoever. But it would not be acceptable to Advaitins because for them there is one reality in which there is the absence of duality. That is, the reality is Brahman. So, as I have referred to earlier, Madhyamika, which talks of Sunya as the reality, is also non-dualistic, but there is no necessity of a substratum for that system. For them, Advaita is not Dvaita, and hence the definition is modulated by putting Yatra, the locus, that is the Brahman. Now, if it is non-dual, the word Eka or Aikya will do. Why Advaita? See, Eka is also monistic. Eka means one. Monism is all right, but there are a number of Vaishnava schools which talk of Eka as the supreme reality, like Vishishta Advaita. They also talk about one reality, that is Vishnu, but that won't be acceptable because he says that there must be absence of the world of duality. That will not come out if you put the philosophy as Eka or Aikya, for which Vishnu is the only reality. But in their scheme of thinking, duality is accepted by Vashishta Advaitins, that won't be accepted by Shankara. And hence, the word Advaita seems to be more appropriate for a pure non-dualistic thinking, since if it does not accept any duality in its understanding of the ultimate reality. In fact, all these Vedantic schools will operate in both the dimensions. That what I have tried to do here is to show how Advaita has some ideas of Dvaita also. And Dvaita also has some ideas of conceptions of acceptance of some ideas or conceptions of Advaita. So, in fact, all these Vedantic schools will operate in both the dimensions, Advaita and Dvaita. They are Advaitic and Dvaitic at the same time. The problem comes in the emphasis the acharyas lay on the either. For example, even Shankara has to accept the world of duality. Otherwise, for whom the philosophy, the empirical existence, the vyavaharika, so that his mathas and bhashyas and the tradition of teaching and learning are meaningful. To whom he will teach if there is Advaita? It is not for the Jivan Mukta Shankara wrote the bhashyas. It is for the benefit of the people who are in the world of duality and who wants to be liberated. For them, the entire thinking is meaningful. For Vishishta Advaita, it is non-dualistic since it accepts Vishnu as the supreme reality, and even Shankara would have no problem in accepting Vishnu as the supreme reality. The problem between the two is whether to accept or not to accept Maya. In that score, Madhu also talks of the independent status of Vishnu. Even though there is a difference between the God, soul and man, the God is Swatantra, independent, and man is Paratantra. So, indirectly, he too accepts non-duality as far as the independence of the God is concerned. So, we may call his Dvaita Vada as Swatantra Dvaita, where Swatantra of the God is being proved. Chaitanya seems to be tired of all these deliberations and says, let us not brand a philosophy with this and that. The God is beyond thinking, achintya. Hence, he would also support, even though he would support a type of non-dualistic dimension of reality, he would also support a type of non-dualistic dimension of reality, though he follows Madhva's logic of interpretation. From the above, we can say, from a surface level analysis, we find that all the schools, even the hardcore Dvaitins, have to accept both the Advaita dimensions in their philosophical enterprises. But when we get into deep structure of these schools, it would be quite naive to view that they operate on both, because each one of them want to retain his own identity. And there is here where we are in working out the Advaita of Shankara. Why I say this is because the philosophical systems are not like ordinary views which stand to be corrected if found wrong. They are darshanas. See, it is not like earlier Wittgenstein and later Wittgenstein, or earlier Iyer or later Iyer. Wittgenstein told that whatever I wrote in Tractatus can be little verified in my theory of meaning. you know, the philosophical investigation. See, not that type of a philosophy these people have done. They are darshanas. And their views are based on the direct perception. What is darshana? The word indicating philosophy in Indian tradition is darshana. All the acharyas had direct realization. Before I come back to Advaita, I would like to talk a little to this august assembly of scholars. What is meant by darshana in Indian tradition? Etymologically, darshana means seeing. But seeing what? Seeing is a sakarmaka dhatu. Seeing, drish is a sakarmaka dhatu. Darshanam implies the direct realization without any obstruction. Darshanam nama, that is what? Pratibandha rahitam, sansaya rahitam, pratyaksha anumana anapeksham, pratyaksha jnanam. See, darshana, darshan. No, no, there are a lot of means. But what darshana means is the drush, to see. It is not an ordinary visual, not am I seeing you or you are seeing the table. Yeah. So it is not, no, it is not mystical all the times, because Shruti is given as a pramana in Indian tradition. So what he says is, darshana, the perception is not something which is subjected to doubt. It is doubtless. It is not viparya, it does not work. Whether it is right or wrong, it is not an erroneous knowledge. Or it does not depend upon a vyapti jnana or a anumanik or an inferential knowledge. It is not an inferential knowledge. Darshana is the direct perception of the reality. That is how they say. So, it is doubtless, free from error and not dependent on inference. Samsaya rahitam, viparyaya rahitam, anumana anapeksham jnana. The object of this perception is Jiva, Jagat and Ishvara. This is not a weak word like man. I think. See, think and have anything I can think, but darshana is not like that. It is essentially to know one's own self, being a part of the universe. Hence, the teaching is oral in nature. See, that is the oral tradition in India, even Socratic. The dialogues are all in oral tradition. Because there the communication is better. When you tell something and when you write something, there is a difference. Suppose you write, a boy writes to his girlfriend that I love you, and a third person sees, he will not understand what it means. He will say, okay, he loves. But the boy to whom it is, suppose somebody says that I love you, there is a lot of difference. So that is why the oral tradition is so much preeminent in India. See, it is also a Greek tradition. See, the Derridean problem of speech and writing, which is better? The speech is better or writing is better? So anyway, the oral tradition has been the tradition in India, because you can keep the imprint, you can have a better imprint in the student of the ideas that we are trying to impart. So it is essentially to know one's own self, being a part of the universe. Here the teaching is oral in nature, so that it leaves behind a prominent imprint in the mind of the hearer, listener. In the West, we have been having this question whether India has a philosophy or not. Most of the times in the West, the Indian thought is pushed to theology department or some other department, not taught in philosophy department. Such compartmentalization of philosophy and religion is not possible in Indian thinking, nor do we mix them up. See, we don't separate them, nor do we mix them up. Conceptually, both are differentiated. Philosophy is knowledge and religion is attitude. Both can never be separated, nor can they be mixed up. Now, what is that is discussed in the West in the name of philosophy? Philosophy comprises of logic, epistemology, metaphysics and ethics. Logic deals with methods and principles of reasoning. Epistemology deals with origin, source and principles which govern knowledge and nature of truth and error. Metaphysics inquires into the nature of reality. Cosmology is a part of it. Axiology is the study of the values, all that which is desired. Ethics deals with the inquiry into good and right. This is called the hardcore philosophy in Western tradition. Then, does India have a philosophy or the name if you take in this sense? My submission, friends, is that India has a philosophy And in addition to all this that we have talked so far, the four ideas, we have something called liberation, which is spelled out in all the schools. The epistemology and logic are called as the Pramana Shastras in Indian tradition. Metaphysics is called as the Prameya Shastra, the inquiry into what is to be known, the man, world and the God. The Indian thinkers have given a formulation that the ascertainment of Prameya, the object to be known, is dependent on the means of knowledge. Considering the axiology, Indian tradition uses the word Purushartha. The desired object of a person, the desired object should be a proper one. The desired object cannot be that I want to go to a movie or I want to kill a person, not like that. The ethics is included under a different subject called Dharma Shastra. These are the texts which is the basis of religion, if we want to say so. Thus, India has a philosophy, not only a theoretical one, but also which has practical aspects. The way of life is brought in. Thus, in India, we have philosophical discussion and practical discipline. See, in the West, also it is there, but for example, there are certain philosophers like skeptical philosophers like David Hume. They say that the table is nothing but the bunch of, you know, sensations. Now, what is it to be done by a person by knowing that it is only sensations? So, India, therefore, the philosophy is not a theory but also a practice. What they have done is that the thinkers have established a relation between value and action. In this sense, Indian philosophy is value-oriented. Indian philosophy is also to some extent dharma-oriented and primarily moksha-oriented. Among the values, dharma, artha and kama and moksha, the first three are spoken of as having instrumental value and the last one having intrinsic value. The instrumental values would answer the question why. Suppose you ask why artha to live, why artha again to have dharma, but you cannot ask why moksha. Because every time the liberation is the basic form of existence. I want to liberate myself from hunger, I eat. Why you feel hunger, you cannot ask. So happiness, things can be done for happiness. Why you need happiness? What is the answer? It is intrinsic, it has intrinsic value. So, the question of asking a why is not possible for a value which is intrinsic. This is the core of Vedanta, where the liberation comes to be identified with Ananda, Chit and Sat. That is bliss, existence and knowledge. The main idea is to say that all the other values are values for courtesy's sake. They are necessary, but they are not sufficient values. Indian philosophy is action-oriented because there is close relation between value and action, and since it is value-oriented, it is action-oriented. So there is nothing wrong to say Indian philosophy is philosophy even from the Western standards. So now we have to know such a value which culminates in liberation. Now, how do we know such a value which culminates in liberation? The Vedantic thinkers are vociferous in saying that it is Shruti which shows the way. That is the meeting point of all the Vedantins, and Shankara is no exception. But one thing which I want to bring home here is that there is a way to get out of the Shruti, and even doing Vedanta, Shruti is not binding to a man all the times. See, there is always, the criticism against Indian Vedantic schools especially. They say, after all, you are working on the presuppositions of the Shruti. It is not something which can be realized, as though they have undergone everything to realize, and therefore they say, see, it is just like my saying that there is nothing in microbiology, because I do not know microbiology. See, that type of an analysis is not right. That is what I am saying, that even doing Vedanta, Shruti is not binding to man all the times. The critics say that Vedanta cannot be done without Shruti. This is true for a beginner, not the man who has reached that unexcelled state. There is no special divinity attached to Shruti in Indian tradition. Metaphorically, of course, it is thought of to be sacred. It is sacred, definitely, because it talks of a spiritual liberation. But all the Vedantic systems have an inbuilt dimension to get out of Shruti, which is supported by Shruti itself. Once the truth is known, the Vedas become Avedas. Yatra Vedaha Avedaha Bhavanti. The Shruti says that there is a time when Veda become Aveda, not Veda. I cite this to say that Indian philosophy and religion has shown the path and shown how to get out of that path, making a more meaningful dimension of liberation possible. I do not think this particular aspect is present, I do not know of course, in any other religion, religious philosophical tradition of the world. The Vedanta, I am talking about all Vedantic tradition, the Vedanta has always made provisions to work with Shruti, and once the purpose is fulfilled, it becomes a part of the Sabda Prapancha, which is operative in the world of our ordinary activities. Prapancha is the world. It is applicable to all the Vedantins. For Ramanuja, the ideal of Prapatti. You don't have to read all the... You say Prapatti, you can be liberated. Chaitanya Sanama Japa, and many such instances can be cited to exemplify this. My purpose here is to show that a question is usually asked if Shankara says that Brahma Satyam and Jagan Mithya. See, Shankara says that Brahman alone is the truth and Jagat is Mithya. Then what happened to that sentence, which is a part of the Jagat? What happened to this line? Brahma Satyam Jagan Mithya, it is the part of the world or not? The answer is that as Shabda, it is also Mithya. But having a denotation, it is true. The word water is not the water. That does not mean that therefore we should not use the word water, which is indicative of that thing called water. Similarly, the Shruti is indicative, and once the object is known, it is not necessary. In that sense, it is said that Vedas become Avedas once the reality is known. This is one of the most peculiar characteristics of Vedantic thinking in particular and Indian philosophy in general. Advaita operates through Shruti to show a holistic life beyond Shruti or the Vedas. Since Veda is very ancient, the Advaita too is very ancient and was available in fragmentary writings before Shankara and Gaudapada. It is usually thought that Shankara is the earliest exponent of the Advaita, which is not true. He may be at best one of the prominent expounders of the school. The first teacher to expound Advaita, as I have spoken earlier, is Gaudapada, who wrote a Karika on Mandukya Upanishad in which he reconciled the Buddhist tenets with that of Upanishadic concepts, showing that Upanishads contain the quintessence of Buddhism and much more than that. There is a teacher-disciple tradition which is usually uttered whenever there is any traditional Advaitic discourse takes place. They say that the first teacher was Lord Narayana himself, and he taught to his son Brahma. Brahma taught to Vasishtha, another Rishi. He taught to his son Shakti, and Shakti taught to his son Parasara. They are all married. In ancient Indian, Rishis were all married, sometimes they married two also. Parasara in turn taught to his son Vyasa, and Vyasa taught to his son Sukha, and Sukha did not marry, he was a sannyasin. Therefore, he taught to his disciple called Gaudapada, and Gaudapada taught Govinda Bhagavatpada, and Govinda Bhagavatpada's student disciple was Shankaracharya. Shankara happens to be the direct disciple of Govinda, and that is how the tradition has been coming down till today. The chief contribution of Shankara in his Bhashyas is his Bhashyas on Prasthanatrayi, the three canons of Vedanta, that is Upanishads, Brahma Sutra and Bhagavad Gita. Before I end this lecture, I would like to devote a few words about the greatness of Shankara and how he contributed to the synthesis of many traditions, as he is popularly known as Sanmata Sthapana Charya, a person who established the six traditions which were getting lost because of the onslaught of Buddhism. In seeking to discover the greatness of Shankara, we should not isolate him from his age. The historical individual is definitely inseparable from the society in which he lived. The works of Shankara can only be understood in terms of religio-cultural trends in the 7th to 8th centuries in India. This period may be the period of transition from a classical to early medieval age. There was the Buddhism, which was fast declining, and Smartha Pauranika religion was emerging, having very rigid social dimension, though they are Catholic as far as their spirituality is concerned. Bhakti and Tantra, abstract logic and polemical metaphysics, ritualistic mode of worship and social codes were developing side by side. Shankara not only summed up his age, but founded a tradition which continues till today. He reconstructed the philosophy of Gaudapada and refuted other schools like Samkhya and the like. His non-dualistic interpretation of Vedanta became the core for other schools to support, refute and develop their own thinking. See, because Shankara was available, Ramanuja could refute it. If that was Shankara was not there, I do not know Ramanuja, which way, the traditional, how it would have come. His thinking never encouraged any social eligibility for pursuing Vedanta, for which we have examples like Janaka, Vidura, and large number of those. Shankara brought about a synthesis in accepting Pravritti Dharma and Nivritti Dharma, the life of indulgence and the life of renunciation, respectively. The distinction between Nirguna Brahman and Saguna Brahman provided place for worship without challenging the final thesis that one has to go beyond it. There is also a synthesis for Jnana and Karma, which must have been a dominant topic of debate of his time, and this included an esteemed position for Bhakti. Shankara himself was a great Bhakta, which is evident in large number of Bhakti Stotras he has written. The structure of Vedanta kept enough space for reconciliation of faith, reason and spiritual experience. The identity of the self and Brahman can only be known from Shruti, but it has to be reasonably experienced. See, that is what Shankara's greatness, even Ramanuja's, even Madhva's, even Chaitanya's, everybody. It is almost modeled on the Buddha's saying that Pariksha Madhvacho Grahyo Vikshavo Natu Gauravati. I think you know that Buddha says, O Bhikkhus, you first analyze what I say. Don't accept this because I say this. That is how it is modeled on that. Reasoning is needed to do away with the defects like impossibility of such a state of realization and impossibility of realizing such an entity, which are called as Asambhavana and Viparita Bhavana. There is difficulty in providing proper history about the life and works of Shankara because of absence of any authentic biographical source about him. What has happened in the so-called biographies is that the history has been largely replaced by legends. The existing mathas and literature available at those places are not of much help to come to a conclusive date of the advent of Shankara. One important aspect of Shankara's analysis is that it begins with a faith in Shruti. It takes other hermeneutic channels like rational reflection to transcend and interpret the Shruti, and also to negate the instinctive and philosophical prejudices against it, so that the personal experience could become possible. The analysis of self-awareness is a significant part of this process. He never negates the world, as has been accused by the opponents. He models his philosophy on the basis of two truths. There are two truth philosophy. He is one of the earlier Indian thinkers who shows how to refute other schools. In doing Advaita, he appeals to two basic principles, that the subject can never become the object. Subject, karta, can never become the karma, and a real can never be sublated. A real, the sublation, you cannot falsify a real entity. On the basis of this, he says that empirical consciousness and existence are false or illusory. The transcendental falsity is compatible with pragmatic authenticity, so that there is possibility of discovery of truth by adhyaropa and apavada, which is in English superimposition and subsequent negation. The whole endeavor of Shankara is not only to establish a philosophy of Advaita by the negation of Maya or ignorance, which is the cause of universe, but it is more to show the Indian the tradition as to how there is an amount of non-dualism in whatever they do, and he has been successful in doing so. Hence, there is a need to see Shankara from a different angle, which is what is being attempted here. As I have told earlier, Shankara was a product of his time, and with that sympathetic eye, we must perceive him and his contribution. Swami Vivekananda once said, if Ramanuja would have born at the period of Shankara, he would have only taught only Advaita. thank you for giving me this patient hearing, and I can take questions if you want to ask. No. He says
knowledge is necessary.
Bhakti is necessary. Shankara says, Ramanuja says, knowledge is necessary but not sufficient. Shankara says the exactly opposite.
But the final effect comes to be the same though. When something is necessary, it has to be in that within that prescription.
Let me just tell, I got your point. There is, the logic, there is something called a necessary condition and sufficient condition, okay? They are different from each other. That is why whatever, it may be necessary, but it is not sufficient to get that. So for Shankara, bhakti is necessary. Mukhya samagri. Bhaktireva mokhya sadhana samagriyam bhaktireva gariyasi. So yes, thank you. So in the causes, the means of mokhya, the bhakti has a preeminent place. That is what is being said. But it is not sufficient for Shankara. What gives ultimate liberation is knowledge. But this is diametrically opposite for Ramanuja.
When you sit and think about it, something is
That is what I am telling. The distinction has to be made between sufficient and necessary. Exactly. According to So it is jnana spiced with bhakti. Ultimately, you know.
What I am saying is something is necessary. A is necessary. So you put A there, but A on its own cannot
do that, right?
But B on its own is sufficient to get to there. But even then, because you say A is necessary at the very beginning, so in the equation both A and B have to be there. Do you see what I wrote the logic? Well, in the other way around, Ramanuja says bhakti and jnana both are necessary.
Yeah, Ramanuja identifies both. That's right. Yeah. Which has devotion as its main theme, essence. That is what Ramanuja says. See, for Shankara, bhakti can be there. Bhakti may be there. Without bhakti also, if knowledge comes, one can be liberated. That's what you mean to say? Yes, that is accepted for Shankara.
Yeah, but then it bhakti cannot be a necessary condition.
No, but see, why it is told is, for Shankara himself, if you analyze the things, you find, even 13th chapter of Gita, Shankara says that bhakti can only cleanse the mind to make yourself eligible for getting liberation, jnana to come.
Yeah.
Unless the mind is cleansed, you cannot have that. Knowledge is ultimately the means to liberation. However, bhakti is required to make your mind, eligible or so to say fit to reflect that knowledge. That is what is the, whatever English word you use, that is the idea. Yes, please. No, Ramanuja is not accepting jiva mukti. Ramanuja does not accept. He accepts only videha mukti. But, of course, Madhva also does not accept. Does Chaitanya accept?
Yeah.
Huh?
He accepts jiva mukti, but it's
now, in that way, that's right. See, even Professor Narasimha Sari used to say, that if you analyze the essential points of Nitya Suris Are they not Jivan Muktas? He used to say that there is possibility of accepting Jivan Mukti in Vishishta Dvaita also. But Jivan Mukti as such is not accepted by the system.
So what sort of
one may behave as a
Exactly.
Jivan Mukti. In fact, where are the risk and ultimate
That's right. Similar to those who are correct.
But such a thing is not possible because it's in contradiction to God.
Yeah. Totally free from the body. The Maya cannot bind you at all. If you are in the being the body. See, that has been a problem in post Sankara Advaita, which I will deal little later. That whether even in Sankara's philosophy, in the Sankara's tradition, there are people having doubts whether we can accept Jivan Mukti. But Sankara was very vociferous about the idea that we have to accept Jivan Mukti. He says, if somebody says that he is liberated, you cannot question him. I don't remember that passage at this minute, but that is what you cannot disown or dispute with another man's experience of liberation. That is what he says, Sankara. So Sankara is very clear about the fact that there is the possibility of Jivan Mukti. How the Jivan Mukti is possible, that is being discussed in post Sankara Advaita. We'll talk about that little later in the other classes when we talk about the liberation. Thank you. Thank you, sir. It is all because of you.
May I be wicked? If you can give me a copy.
Why not tomorrow?
Definite?
Yeah. Would you give me that machine here? And I hope it's.
I'm graced by your presence, Krishna Kirti.